It's the News Roundup, where we discuss the region's top stories of the week. Joining us this week, Paul Pronovo, editor at the Cape Cod Times. Morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mindy.
And Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor here at WCAI. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning, Mindy.
Well, last two weekends have been pretty snowy, and we've heard some varying forecasts leading into this weekend, but looks like it's going to be mostly a rain event for us. Whew.
Yes.
Yeah, and if you looked at my driveway and saw the packed ice still encrusting the whole place, I'm personally not disappointed, and I'm sure most Cape Codders are not disappointed either. We've had a few different snow events over the past couple weeks, as you mentioned. They've been tough, especially a couple weeks ago, as we talked about it, just before it snowed. You know, that weekend was very tough. People were without power for from a day to several days, and folks last weekend were almost suffering from PTSD as a result of it. You know, hotels were saying, oh, people were calling us even before a snowflake fell last week, even though forecasts suggested that it would never be as bad as the prior week. So to have rain this week, I think, is probably welcome news for all folks. We're ready for spring at this point. But, you know, heck, it's New England. It hasn't been that bad a winter. And it's funny, when you go around, I'm sure you've heard of people say this, people complaining about the winter, and I think, okay, we've had, what, two, three significant snows? I mean, really,
yeah,
it hasn't been that bad.
So yeah, not too bad.
We'll get out.
Yeah, and I don't think it'll snow anymore because I bought snowshoes.
So, oh.
Yeah. Well, and plus the Red Sox are playing now, so I think spring has begun.
And so all those runners that are here for the marathon coming up in Hyannis this weekend, looks like their race is going to happen.
Oh, yeah. That's Sunday. That's always a good event.
Yeah.
Yeah, and 5,000 runners. So this, you know, it's not exactly the New York Marathon where they had all those considerations last fall about canceling the event because, you know, tens of thousands of people come in. But 5,000 people coming into the greater Hyannis area for an event is pretty significant. So they watched this snow very carefully. They had said they were going to wait until the very last minute, probably even Sunday morning, before they decided to cancel. But now with the forecast looking as it is, they're saying, you know, if you're planning to run, plan on coming down.
Yeah.
And runners, though, please be careful because there is still a lot of black ice out there. So even though it might be raining Saturday night into Sunday, the conditions might be still
loose. Yeah, especially if we're hubbing around freezing. Yep. Well, those two storms that we were just talking about that walloped the coastline were a little too much for one of those remaining North Beach cottages.
Right, and recall Seashore Superintendent George Price arguing for the better part of a year that the remaining six North Beach cottages should be torn down. He said they were too vulnerable to the weather. It was inevitable that they were going to go over in a storm. And everyone from the folks who had basically leases on those cottages to the town of Chatham really fought against it.
Mm-hmm.
And understandably, I mean, the cottages are iconic. They've been part of the landscape out there on that spit of sand for a very long time. Well, for a long time up until 91, where the no-name storm took them all out and then they were rebuilt. They've been there. The current cottages have been there since 91. But still, Price, it seems like, is proving to be correct. Here, one of the cottages went basically fell off its foundation. The folks who control it said, we're not going to try to rebuild it, tear it down. And it's exactly what George Price said at the time.
Yeah.
And, of course, the concern is if they don't tear them down, they go over in a storm, and then you have debris everywhere. You have a real major situation. So that's why Price really wanted to get that taken care of.
Yeah, and I guess you can understand, like you're saying, you know, if you're one of the people who are, you know, visiting those cottages in the summer, it's a tough thing to let go of.
Oh, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah, and you don't want to give up without a fight. I mean, that's understandable, but it's amazing how quickly the geography out there is changing. I mean, now, from this latest storm, we now have a new inlet, and it's a significant one that's pouring water in from the Atlantic into that little bay area. That is going to quickly reshape the sand as it already has. I think it was a couple years ago we had a new break in the North Beach area that at first they thought would close up, but then got wider and deeper and has remained there. So this is not new. Erosion and the landscape of the Cape and the islands is constantly shifting. I think when it happens rapidly like it is right now, it surprises us, but it really shouldn't. I mean, historically speaking, this has gone on for forever.
Right. Well, Mashpee Wampanoag tribal elections are coming up this weekend, and some tribe members are voicing concerns.
Well, and these concerns date back to the last tribal election. You know, as with all politics, the tribes' politics have folks on all sorts of sides of the issue, and especially folks who lost the election complain that maybe there was some underhanded politics involved. So they've complained, they've filed actions, they want to have this election supervised in such a way that it avoids what they believe is some of the malfeasance. For example, certain people who didn't show tribal identification being able to vote, or folks who had been shunned being allowed to vote when they feel that due process wasn't had. Of course, on the other side, there are folks who say, look, we're following all the rules of our tribe's constitution, essentially. We are ensuring that the rules are followed and everything seems fine. So this is sort of the interplay going into this election. We'll see. It's going to be a very interesting election. There's several contested races. Cedric Cromwell, who's been the tribe's chairman and has led, among other things, the casino push in recent years. He's contested, and right down the line, the entire slate of elected officers are challenged. So we'll have to see what comes of it.
Yeah, it looks like 17 tribe members are getting involved in this election, seeking different offices. And, you know, and what you hear from Cromwell and people who support him is, hey, this isn't a time for a leadership change. We have this, we're negotiating a gaming compact with the state right now. We're in the midst of that. That could be set back. We're trying to get land into trust with the federal government. They had some success there, some preliminary success. So they're saying, let's not make any major changes. But, of course, the leadership always says that.
Right.
And there are different factions within the tribe.
Right.
There always have been.
Right.
You know, we have sort of in the American political system, we have different parties. The tribe has different parties, almost family-based, it seems. You see very familiar names running for office almost as a block against another block, and you can sort of go down the family history and see connections through the tribe. So it's fascinating to see.
Yeah.
It's all part of the tribe being able to govern themselves, and it's a healthy part of government process.
I did drive by the tribe's new the headquarters of the tribe on Meeting House Road in Mashpee, and they've got the steel up. It is a tremendous work site going on there. Dozens of vehicles. I mean, I cannot wait to see what they come up with. And of course, this is a direct result of being federally recognized and having some money come in.
Well, you mentioned gambling, and the tribe has spent a bit more this year than last on gambling lobbyists.
Yeah, this is interesting. The Associated Press took a look at the money that's been poured into lobbying efforts and compared essentially 2011 and 2012. And interestingly, as the amount of money this past year went down in 2012 from 2011 in general, the amount of money the tribe spent on lobbying went up. In fact, it essentially doubled to about $500,000 that the tribe spent. An easy explanation for this in the sense that what the tribe was doing that the rest of sort of the gaming interest didn't have to do was the tribe was negotiating a compact with the Commonwealth. So they had very specific interests in convincing both the governor and state lawmakers that a compact should be put in place. It's one of the building blocks they have to have in order to have a casino. And go back a year, 2011, that's when they were trying to discuss and decide and debate over whether there should be gaming at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why gaming interests, more generally speaking, were pumping money into the system and trying to convince lawmakers just to vote in favor of gaming in the first place.
And of course, we also have that land into trust deal.
Yeah, and this is, well, that's a whole subset it's interesting because the Mashpee Wampanoag are looking for federal approval to bring land into trust. It looks like they're essentially poised to do that. And part of what I think is going on behind the curtain is that the tribe negotiated with Governor Patrick. They gave a significant portion of the revenue the revenue projected to the Commonwealth. In return, the tribe got the governor to commit to basically lobby on their behalf. Mm-hmm. Pretty high-powered lobbyist when you're the governor and you have the ear of the president. That seems pretty good for the tribe. So now things are starting to fall into place for them in terms of this whole land into trust situation. They still have many steps to take, but it seems to be lining up at this point. Of course, we've said that before. Mm-hmm. Seems like they had a ton of momentum, then hit a few stumbles along the way. So we'll see where it goes. This is going to be a big year, I think,
for
the tribe. Has to be.
So this $500,000 was state lobby money. We didn't get any federal lobby money. That hasn't been totaled up, at least not by the AP. But in addition to Governor Patrick, he also has the tribe also has former Congressman Delahunt lobbying down in Washington for them. So there's a lot of lobbying going on, which basically often translates into contributing money to people's campaigns.
And I'd like to see money. I mean, the AP looked at state contributions, but frankly, I'd love to see what sort of money is floating around in the city of Taunton and the city of Springfield and some of these places where casinos are being proposed. You know that the nest is being feathered right now. We don't know exactly how. We do know, by comparison, Middleborough was very upset because they had money already coming into the town even before the deal was set. Obviously, they moved away from Middleborough. Middleborough realizes that they lost out on a whole bunch of money. So I wonder what's happening in the Tauntons and the Springfields of the world.
News Roundup, we're talking about the top stories of the week with Paul Pronovo, editor at the Cape Cod Times, and Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor here at WCAI. Cape Wind securing more funding, moving closer to becoming a reality.
Right, and these are the necessary steps that they have to take. Obviously, the Cape Wind discussion has been focused a lot on sort of the politics and the aesthetics of it. Now we're down to the money. And the money is really where, for Cape Wind, it either makes or breaks it. So while this seems like an incremental step, I think it's fairly important. They've announced, Jim Gordon announced that they've secured the Tokyo Mitsubishi Bank to basically be the lead bank in moving forward with funding. What their role will be is to line up several other banks because there's a lot of money that has to be poured into this project, committed to this project before it can even get off the ground. And as they're talking still ambitiously about having work started at least by December 31st this year, they have a lot of movement to make in terms of lining up the money. They've lined up a lot. They have, I think, National Grid has agreed to buy about 50% of the power. NSTAR, I believe it's 27%. They still have to get a purchase agreement for the remaining about 0.25%, but that's well underway. They have some funding commitments, but still a lot of ground to make up. For example, they had looked for sort of a federal loan to help them in 2011 and floated this notion of a $2 billion basically loan to protect the project, have the federal government insure it, essentially. That never went forward. It got caught up in you know, the whole Solyndra situation where about a half a billion dollars was poured into that, and then the solar company went bankrupt. So politically speaking, they had to back off, but you can expect that they're going to come to the feds pretty soon looking for probably a smaller amount. One more step in the process, and we'll see what happens. It's big money at stake here. Obviously, it's what will make or break this project.
It's the ultimate process story, Cape Wind.
Yes,
I mean,
for sure.
Rarely does a news roundup go by that we don't mention the proposal to install 130 wind turbines in Nantucket Sound. And now we're in the financial part of the processes. Actually, we've been in that part a while.
Right.
I mean, before the economy dropped out, we were talking about Neiman Brothers being the ones coordinating the financing of the project. Now, Neiman Brothers is no longer in existence. So this is interesting. They're still going for that loan guarantee. We'll see what happens with that. And it's interesting just to have a number. $2.6 billion for a decade. We didn't have any idea what this was going to cost. It was all just, you know, pluck a number from the sky and hope for the best. We'll see. They're saying that they need to begin construction by the end of the year in order to get these tax credits, but we've heard that before as well, and tax credits are often, so far, always renewed.
Yeah, and it's interesting. We should point out that the opponents say, look, we've heard this before, and they feel that they feel it's almost gamesmanship where Cape Wind has been making statements and issuing press releases to sort of demonstrate a level of momentum that they believe is sort of a shell and that isn't exactly there. And they point out that there are still lawsuits that exist, that a lot of the funding is still not tied up, and they believe that that's not a good sign for the project. In fairness to Cape Wind, this story this week wasn't a press release. This was a statement that Jim Gordon made to industry insiders that, quite frankly, he probably didn't even think was going to go public. It wasn't his intention. So this was not exactly some big press conference that Cape Wind had. Nonetheless, the opponents say that they have a lot of hurdles to get over, and they do.
Well, speaking of money, if the federal budget cuts go into effect next week, the National Seashore is going to be facing some challenges.
Well,
not just the seashore.
I mean the whole federal government, of course, if this budget sequester happens, feels like just yesterday that we were talking about the fiscal cliff at the end of the at the end of the year, and here we are again. And even as they were tying up the loose ends of the so-called fiscal cliff in the beginning of January, we knew that some of the cans were getting kicked down the road, and this is one of them. The whole idea of a deficit reduction plan that Congress and the White House have to agree to. If they don't, by March 1st, an automatic 10% across the board budget cut will happen. There's some sacred cows that won't be cut, such as Medicaid, I believe, and food stamps and things like that. But otherwise, from defense programs to social services to the seashore, will be cut. What that means in practical terms for us on Cape Cod, it means that, among things, the Province Lands Visitor Center might be closed all summer. A lot of beach access could be limited because the folks who monitor the endangered birds, such as piping plovers, there wouldn't be money to hire those people. And if you can't be monitoring the birds, you can't allow people access because, frankly, you don't know where they can go. That would be a pretty significant impact.
Yeah.
It amounts to about $400,000 in budget reduction for the seashore, which in the grand scheme, when you're talking billions and trillions, doesn't seem like a lot of money. But for a small area in the you know, this end of the fiscal year for the feds, which ends in October, of course, coincides with summer, which is our high season. So to save all that money in such a short time in the high season could be pretty devastating. And this is something that was pointed out by the National Park Service Retirees Group, which took a look at all National Park Service budgets and broke down pieces that they thought would be of interest to folks. And this certainly would be one around here. The National Seashore is a huge draw. We know that I think it's more than 4 million people go every single year. And it would be a serious impact.
Yeah.
I think we're getting a little weary of these self-created crises that the government keeps pushing upon us. I mean, you notice even the stock market isn't really reacting to this one quite yet. But this is important journalism, because what happens, journalists kind of hate these stories where you're kind of looking towards the future. What will happen if? But we do them all the time. And what happens with this type of story is when journalists around the country, local journalists, start to look at the projects that will be affected if these cuts go into effect, the congressmen read that in their local paper. They know that their constituents are reading that, and that actually applies pressure down in Washington to eventually come to some sort of agreement. So we're seeing that play out, and that's why these stories are important. Do we know exactly what will happen if this goes through? No, we don't.
Yeah, but that's a good point.
They're listening.
Hopefully they're listening.
And we've seen the budget get locked up before. We know that the partisan atmosphere in Washington, D.C. is really been counterproductive, to say the least. So we all hope Sean's right. And I think he is right in terms of the pressure it applies. The key will be if it's enough pressure to get both sides diametrically opposed to come to the middle.
The thing that drives me crazy with this, and I'm sure drives a lot of people crazy, is it's always the last minute. You know what I mean? We drag this out to the last minute.
It's brinksmanship.
Sometimes beyond the last minute, and as we saw with the fiscal cliff, to the last minute, and then you just deal with what is the low-hanging fruit, and you push everything down the line, hoping that it gets addressed later.
Thanks. Well, we have a mystery on our hands that have marine historians trying to figure out the origins of a piece of a ship that was found in Hyannis Harbor. These are always the fun mysteries here.
This is fascinating. And Brian Braggington Smith, who folks know around the Cape in a lot of different ways, one of the things he does is a lot of ocean surveying. And in January, during an astronomically low tide, he was out in the Lewis Bay area, which is essentially the outer harbor of Hyannis Harbor, and found what is believed to be remains of a ship. So that part seems to be true. Where that ship came from, what its origins are, is sort of a mystery, and it's sort of playing out in a fun way. There's a lot of local lore that this could actually be a British warship from 1812. That hasn't been confirmed, but a lot of folks love that story.
Yeah.
And in fact, it could be true. There's certainly a lot of vessels in and around the Cape during that time. There was some wonder if it's a connection to the cannons out in front of the Superior Court courthouse in Barnstable Village. Well, Patrick Cassie, one of our reporters, went out and looked at the plaque outside that courthouse, and they think those cannons came from Fort Ticonderoga. So maybe not, but
but it's pretty cool,
which is pretty cool in itself. Exactly,
it's a long way.
So anyway, it's Bradington Smith and his team have pulled up the pieces, reassembled them like a little bit of a jigsaw puzzle. So they know what part of basically it would be a cannon support system where it would be plugged into a ship, and they're cleaning it up. They have it in a bay of water at the Zooquarium right now, and they're trying to figure out the origins.
It's really interesting. It's almost like something out of a movie if it is true, this idea that during the War of 1812 there was a British blockade of the Cape, and that some local mariners pretty much brought down the ship, sunk the ship.
Right.
It's a great story. They haven't been able to confirm it yet. I also like the idea, the process that they're putting this piece of wood through in order to preserve it is that I guess they soak it in fresh water for about 2 years to pull the salt out of it. And then they use some sort of chemical process so that they can display it out in the air.
But, you know, I mean, thank goodness there's people like Brian who know what they're looking at. If I came across that, I wouldn't, in my wildest dreams, think that was something. I think it was a piece of driftwood or something. You know, it'd still be laying in the water.
Well, and it was really a who knew story when I first saw this. Who knew that they were even looking at all in Hyannis Harbor? I mean, what do you expect to find in Hyannis Harbor after all these years? And yet here they are looking. And we know, of course, that there's a long and rich history of shipwrecks in and around the Cape and the islands. So that's not a surprise. What to me was a surprise that it would be so tight into, frankly, a very congested body of water. And after all this time, someone's finding something new. That's
pretty
cool.
That's very cool, And you're talking about the process, Sean, and we had another story about the shipwreck Whydah and preserving and restoring artifacts, which kind of speaks to that and how they do this. This is really fascinating.
Yeah, basically they are... they've been pulling pieces of the Whydah up for a number of years now. I think, when did Barry Clifford discover the Whydah first? I think 1984. Yeah. And for the longest time, they knew they had found a ship. They thought it belonged to Black Sam Bellamy, the captain of the Whydah. Legendary, went down in a gale outside of Wellfleet. So they found a boat that sort of fit the description of where Black Sam's boat went down, but for the longest time couldn't positively identify it with the Whydah. They kept pulling things up, but nothing with an identifying mark, until finally they pulled up a bell that had the name Whydah on it. And this was a few years ago. So this most recent discovery, where they found again an imprint with the word Whydah on it, I think it's actually Whydah G for galley, was significant on basically a reverse imprint on an anchor that they pulled up. And basically they've been painstakingly chipping away the rock and the debris that forms, sort of encrusts the various things, and in this case an anchor. They have it encased in water, as is the case with Bradington Smith's piece from the cannon, and they're air blasting off in a very precise way the bits of rock until they reveal what's underneath. And that's how they found this name. And in fact, it's a reverse print of the name, because they think the actual thing that applied the name Whydah was probably pressed up against it. They think maybe even a musket was pressed up against it. And that has long since gone.
Yeah.
But it left a mark on the anchor that gives them more proof that, in fact, the wreck is from the Whydah.
Yeah. Really fascinating, too, when you would think you've got these things that have, been there on the ocean floor for how many years, and you pull them up, and that whole chemical reaction. Some things you can pull up and they'll be fine. Other things, pulling them up out of the water, they disintegrate.
I mean, this was a ship that sunk in 1717, like almost 300 years ago, and it's the only intact wreck of a pirate ship that's ever been found right here off Cape Cod.
And it's interesting. Barry Clifford, of course, has had a museum dedicated to this out in, on the wharf in Provincetown for many years. A very popular draw. Just as a side note, it looks like they could be bringing all or at least piece of that exhibit to the Hyannis Armory. That's something that would give it even more publicity, if you would. And because, it is one of those sort of best kept secrets out in P-Town. If you don't know what's under that Jolly Roger flag at the end of the wharf, to go in and explore, you might not do it. So to maybe bring it down to Hyannis will not only show a greater number of folks some of these exhibits, but also get into the science of how there are
Although I love that it's the end of the wharf there. I mean, that is just the perfect spot for it. All right, so Truro might not be the town that comes to mind when you're researching pollution and climate change, but in fact, that is what's happening.
Well, it's perfect in many ways, even though the town itself is obviously the least populated on Cape Cod. Its geographic location makes it good for pollution studies because it's almost, I think as reporter Marianne Bragg wrote, it's almost like you're out in a boat, but you're not in a boat.
Right.
So you have a lot of the atmospheric conditions, sort of this narrow spit of land surrounded by water. You also are sort of located at the, and we talk a lot about the Midwest tailpipe where prevailing winds drive pollution and smog from the Midwest directly across Cape Cod, and it travels almost literally across Truro. This is why it makes for a perfect place for a study. And there are scientists now conducting, I think, a multi-year review that began in July, looking at particulates in the air. And so far, they're coming up with, unfortunately, what they expected in terms of smog and pollutants and what their atmospheric effect is. They were demonstrating some of their results this week, and they're going to be looking more this summer. They're floating weather balloons off the old Truro Air Station last summer, which folks were curious about what that was all about. We wrote about it at the time, but now we're starting to see the results of their studies.
Yeah. Well, new reality show coming to the Vineyard.
Yeah.
Mixed feelings about this one.
Oh, they're mixed, are they?
I think so, yeah. Some people not too happy about that.
I can see that. I mean, I don't think that the Jersey Shore show did a lot for the Jersey Shore. Right. It didn't exactly improve that reputation. These real-world-like shows have a reputation for, you know, glorifying drinking and general obnoxious behavior. I don't know if the producers are coming looking for shellfishing and riding on the merry-go-round. They're probably looking for that same type of outrageous behavior.
Well,
they
say no.
We'll see.
But, you know.
Oh, okay.
Well, it's ABC Family, and the producers say the producer is the same person who has done The Biggest Loser. So I guess in reality show parlance, that's good news. again, they say that they're not looking to be sensational, but I mean, honestly, nobody tunes in to watch someone playing checkers. I mean, they tune in for something interesting. So what will that mean?
Wait a second. Checker players are getting upset right now.
Yes, I'm very sorry to all checker players. I'm with you all the way. But we will have to see what comes of this show. Also, I found interesting, it looks like they're, and maybe I'm mistaken about this, looking to produce the show in May and June, which is hardly the high season. So if they really want to capture the Vineyard, they got to come back in July and August. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we'll wait and see before we pass judgment on what the show is going to be like. Paul Pronovo, editor at the Cape Cod Times. Sean Corcoran, senior reporter and editor here at WCAI. Thank you both.
Thank you, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening. The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point, WCAI. Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.